Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Liberia closes its borders to curb the Ebola outbreak, and France is to lead the Air Algeria black box analysis. I'm Francis Alonso reporting from Washington. Liberia is closing most of its borders in an attempt to contain an outbreak of the Ebola virus, which has killed nearly 700 people in West Africa. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf announced late Sunday that Monrovia's international airport and three major border crossings would remain open with measures in place to prevent spreading the disease. The government has also banned public gatherings, including events and demonstrations. Liberia has seen 127 deaths from Ebola, which has no vaccine or no known cure. The black boxes from an Air Algeria flight that crashed in Mali last week, killing all 118 people on board, arrived in Paris today as France takes the lead in the investigation. France's transport minister said reviewing the data from the jet could take weeks. Flags flew at half-mast in France today as the country began 3 days of mourning for the victims, which include 54 French nationals. The last contact made with the plane was when the pilots asking to turn back en route from Burkina Faso to Algeria. A sandstorm in the area may have played a role in the crash, but no official cause has been determined. Two female suicide bombers carried out deadly attacks today in northern Nigeria, the latest violence to rock the city of Kano. One woman blew herself up as she stood in line with other women who were waiting to buy kerosene for cooking, killing three people. Hours later, a second bomber blew herself up in a commercial district of the city, injuring six. A second oil storage tank is on fire near the Libyan capital, overwhelming firefighters in a situation that one official says is out of control. A spokesman for the National Oil Company told Reuters a rocket hit the second tank today during clashes between militias fighting for control of the nearby airport. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, says the shooting down of the Malaysia Airlines plane on July 17th may amount to a war crime. Lisa Schlein has details from Geneva.
Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay is calling for a prompt, thorough, independent investigation to establish the circumstances that led to the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. Her spokesman, Rupert Colville, says no one believes it was an accident. He says it's widely accepted that the plane was shot down.
The proof about who exactly is not there yet, and that's why you need the full investigation. But if this plane was shot down, as most people seem to think, then obviously the question of whether this is a war crime would come up. It contained around 300 civilians, and they were killed.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Taiwan, where last week's plane crash and bad weather killed 48 people, the country's aviation authority is following through on orders from the president to draft a series of new air safety rules. Ralph Jennings has details.
Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou has asked his cabinet to strengthen commercial flight safety after a twin-engine prop jet operated by Taiwan-based TransAsia Airways crashed near the main airport in the outlying Penghu Islands. The plane with 58 aboard crashed and caught fire last Wednesday on its second attempt to land. Lin Junliang, leader of the Civil Aeronautics Administration's Air Safety Standards Group, expects a tightening of at least four existing rules to answer the president's demands. He says that every department is busy with the aftermath of the plane crash and matters related to the families of victims, and coordinating that with a series of specific measures that follow the president's order. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says Gaza is in critical condition and that both Israel and Hamas militants are to blame. The UN chief joined world leaders today in calling for an immediate ceasefire. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States will stand up for religious minority communities under assault and in danger around the world. Kerry spoke at the release of the State Department's annual report on international religious freedom. He said that freedom to profess and practice one's faith is a birthright. I'm Francis Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Suspected Boko Haram fighters have kidnapped an influential traditional ruler and Muslim spiritual leader in northern Cameroon, along with his family. The kidnappers also seized the wife of a government minister during their raid in the border town of Kolofata, near Nigeria's Borno State.
That's VOA's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting for Maroua, capital of far north Cameroon. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Liberia is closing most of its borders in an attempt to contain an outbreak of the Ebola virus, which has killed nearly 700 people in West Africa. And millions of Muslims across the world are celebrating the Eid al-Fitr holiday, marking the end of the fasting month of Ramadan.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf closed most of Liberia's borders last night to prevent the spread of the Ebola epidemic. The virus has killed more than 660 people in four West African countries since the first Ebola case was confirmed in rural Guinea in March of this year. Airports in the capital, Monrovia, and three major Liberian border crossings with stringent health testing procedures will stay open, but all public gatherings have been banned in Liberia. Medical doctors, nurses, and public health volunteers are falling victim to Ebola in increasing numbers. Patrick Sawyer, a health and sanitation consultant with the Liberian Ministry of Health, is the first confirmed Ebola case in Nigeria. Sawyer collapsed in the Lagos airport on arrival from Freetown last Thursday. His death was announced on Friday. Dr. Samuel Brisbane contracted the virus while treating Ebola patients at Freetown's largest hospital, the John F. Kennedy Hospital, and he died on Friday. Two Americans who tested positive with Ebola symptoms have been placed in isolation at a Monrovia hospital. Kent Brantley, a physician working with the NGO Samaritan's Purse, and Nancy Wrightbull, a missionary worker, are reported in serious but stable condition at Elwha Hospital. Wrightbull had been working as a hygienist detoxifying protective suits worn by those entering and exiting an Ebola isolation center. Last week, a family stormed a hospital in Freetown, Sierra Leone, and left with their daughter. The 33-year-old woman had been in isolation with Ebola. On Saturday, she died while being returned to the hospital in an ambulance.
Millions of Muslims across the world are celebrating the Eid al-Fitr holiday, marking the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. Many gather for prayers and happily take part in feasts today in such countries as Indonesia and Egypt. But the holiday is a somber one for those in places like the Gaza Strip and Malaysia. Hundreds of worshippers at the National Mosque in Kuala Lumpur prayed for the victims of two Malaysia Airlines flights, one that was shot down over eastern Ukraine earlier this month and another that disappeared during a flight to Beijing in March. In Gaza, Muslims prayed during a lull in Israeli airstrikes and mourned some of the more than 1,000 people who have been killed in 3 weeks of fighting. Eid al-Fitr celebrates the purification achieved during Ramadan, a month of sunrise to sunset fasting, one of the five pillars of Islam.
Nine minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. At least one person has been killed in a suicide bombing in the northern Nigerian city of Kano, the third bombing there in the past 24 hours, and the second by a female attacker. The latest attack targeted women who were lined up today to buy kerosene. Yesterday, an attack on a Catholic church in Kano killed five people. In a separate incident, a female suicide bomber was the only fatality in an attempt to kill police there. Violence blamed on Islamist group Boko Haram over the past few days prompted Kano authorities to cancel festivities marking the major Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr.
Cameroon is observing the end of Ramadan with its military on high alert following a spate of violent attacks by the Nigerian Islamist group Boko Haram. The violence has left at least 10 people dead and included the kidnappings of an influential Muslim spiritual leader and the wife of Cameroon's vice prime minister. Reporter Moki Edwin-Kinzeka has the details from Maroua capital of far north Cameroon.
Residents of Kolofata say heavily armed men stormed their locality late Saturday and started shooting indiscriminately in the air, ransacking houses and looting. They seized the town's mayor, Seni Buka Lamin, who is also a traditional ruler and Muslim spiritual leader. Advisor to the cleric, Alidu Dandama, told VOA in a telephone interview what happened. He says the assailants kidnapped the Lamido, or traditional and Muslim spiritual leader of Kolofata, and all of his family, and they also took the wife of Vice Prime Minister Amadu Ali, who handles relations between the National Assembly and assemblies of other countries. According to Dandama, the armed men headed towards Nigeria's Borno State with Ali's wife. He adds the assailants surrounded the minister's house for nearly an hour. Cameroon's military has not commented directly on the kidnappings, but communication officer Frederick Masogi said on state radio there has been fierce fighting between Cameroonian soldiers and heavily armed men from Nigeria.
L'extrême nord vient d'enregistrer une énième attaque.
He says northern Cameroon has again been attacked by hundreds of heavily armed Boko Haram members, and the country's military is bravely defending its territory and its citizens. Ignatius Ndi, a resident of Maroua, regional capital of Cameroon's far north region, told VOA in a telephone interview soldiers fighting in the border area have been receiving reinforcements from Maroua.
The atmosphere here is one of fear and uncertainty because of the repeated attacks.
The atmosphere here is that of fear and uncertainty because of repeated attacks. The atmosphere is really tense, and there are military helicopters circulating in the air, a thing people here are not used to. The population has embarked on serious prayers in mosques and churches, praying that nothing should happen to them, he says. Ndi adds that lots of people have been fleeing the border with Nigeria to other parts of Cameroon. People who are living in the frontiers have started migrating to Maroua, and it can actually degenerate into an explosion, and to start handling those who are moving from the peripheries to the town will be a difficult situation for the government, he says. This is the second reported kidnapping of Cameroonians by the Nigerian Islamist group. Earlier this month, suspected Boko Haram militants kidnapped two teenage children of one of Cameroon's most influential Muslim spiritual leaders, Bashir Mohamed. The abduction occurred in the town of Limani, also on the border with Nigeria's Borno State, which is the home base of the Islamist group. Moki Edwin-Kinzeka for VOA News, Garoua.
Well, there's a new warning today of growing food shortages in South Sudan. Chris Hilbrunner of the U.S. Aid Fund and Famine Early Warning Systems Network says food insecurity will be worse in 2015 than it is this year. He says although South Sudanese farmers will harvest their crops in the next few weeks, the amount of food is estimated to be too little, too late. For VOA News, Philip Alio has more from Nimule, South Sudan.
Chris Hilbrunner says 4 million South Sudanese are critically food insecure, and he says that number is only to go increase next year if people are not able to produce their own food due to ongoing insecurity displacement, and lack of humanitarian access, among other things. Hilbrana says if people remain stuck in IDP camps and not plan food, the world could be looking at a food crisis in South Sudan by the end of this year.
We're currently in the peak of the lean season, and the situation is very dire in many parts of the conflict-affected states. We're expecting green harvests to start in the next 2 to 4 weeks, and then the main harvest in October. Those harvests are likely to provide some short-term relief, but we think that overall those harvests are going to be below average. And so if the conflict and the market issues and the constraints on humanitarian access aren't resolved, we are very concerned that 2015 could be worse than this year.
Hilbrana says, based on their studies, nearly half of South Sudan's population is critically food insecure. He says food insecurity is measured in paces.
Currently, when we talk about the 4 million people, they are classified as either phase 3 crisis or phase 4 emergency. And this means that they don't have the ability to meet their basic food requirements. So they're eating a reduced diet, a reduced number of meals, and that they're using very extreme coping strategies. So they are selling off assets like livestock, they're begging, they're doing other extreme things to access food.
Hilbrana says people are eating things like wild plants, such as water lilies, to stay alive. Hilbrana says people can no longer go to markets to buy their food because many of them shut down due to insecurity. He says continued fighting in parts of Jonglei, Unity and Upper Nile means that aid agencies are not reaching people who are trapped and most in need.
The assumption is that those people who left the conflict areas they're not doing well, but they're doing better than the people who still remain in Jonglei and Unity. An increasing number of the areas are being reached, but it has been difficult. And there are some areas that have still not received much assistance.
Hilbrana says the reason food insecurity is likely to get worse next year is that people from communities where they are normally food secure have told him that they are still too afraid to venture away from their homes and walk the field because of security concerns. For BOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Numuli.
A second oil storage tank is on fire near the Libyan capital, overwhelming firefighters in a situation one official says is out of control. A spokesman for the National Oil Company told Reuters a rocket hit the second tank today during clashes between militias fighting for control of the nearby airport. Residents within a 5-kilometer radius of Tripoli International Airport were told to evacuate after shelling triggered the first fire at the depot yesterday. Black smoke is billowing from the site after attempts to put the flames out overnight failed. Libyan officials warned the 6 million liter reserves could cause a humanitarian and environmental disaster and ignite nearby liquid gas storages. The militias are in a third week of deadly clashes for control of the airport, crippling air traffic as foreign governments pulled diplomatic staff from the country and encouraged their citizens to leave. Libya has descended into the deadliest violence since the 2011 war that ousted Muammar Gaddafi, with the central government unable to impose order.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The World Health Organization reports viral hepatitis, which kills nearly 1.5 million people a year, could be eliminated. In marking World Hepatitis Day today, WHO says intensifying testing, prevention, and treatment efforts is key to tackling one of the world's most serious diseases. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Viral hepatitis is a largely neglected disease. This may seem strange, as this dangerous alphabet of infectious diseases, hepatitis A, B, C, D, and E, kills nearly as many people as does HIV/AIDS. Hepatitis B and C are most well known and justifiably feared because they cause chronic liver cirrhosis and liver cancer, very often leading to death. Hepatitis B is transmitted from an infected mother to her newborn baby, contact with infected blood, and unprotected sex. Injected drug users are most at risk from hepatitis C, as the disease is spread through the unsafe sharing of needles. Samuel So is a liver transplant surgeon at Stanford University in the United States. He says prevention is the best cure for liver cancer, as there is no effective chemotherapy to treat this disease, which is the second leading cause of cancer deaths after lung cancer. Despite this, he says viral hepatitis can be beaten, a view confirmed by health ministers who attended this year's World Health Assembly. He calls on countries to step up their activities now to eliminate these deadly diseases.
We have a very effective vaccine for 30 years to prevent the future burden of hepatitis B, so they don't develop chronic hepatitis and subsequent liver cirrhosis and liver cancer. And also, in addition, there are now very effective drugs to treat chronic hepatitis B, which is as simple as a pill a day. And you can prevent, like HIV, prevent disease progression to cirrhosis and liver cancer.
The World Health Organization reports more than 500 million people around the world are living with chronic viral hepatitis. About two-thirds of global deaths occur in Asia. The virus also is common in African countries. Most people with hepatitis do not know they are infected. Symptoms usually appear decades after serious liver disease already has set in. This is why WHO urges governments to invest in effective prevention measures. Nevertheless, head of WHO's Global Hepatitis Program, Stefan Victor, says people have reason to be optimistic as great advances are being made in new treatments.
Much of the recent excitement in the area of hepatitis is because of the therapeutic revolution in hepatitis C, and we have a number of new medicines that are have either been approved or and a lot more about to be approved, which really are revolutionizing how we treat hepatitis by shortening the course of treatment to as little as 12 weeks, and in the future maybe even shorter. It's no more injections, these drugs are safe, and they cure almost everybody. It's like 90-95% of people are cured.
But money is a problem. Patients in the United States have to pay $84,000 for a 12-week course of treatment. Dr. Victor agrees this price is out of reach for most people in the world, especially in developing countries. However, he says he expects the price to come down rapidly. He notes just last month, Egypt negotiated an agreement with the manufacturer to receive the drug at a cost of $900 per patient for the 12-week course of treatment. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This week, a UN panel opens a three-day meeting on the aging of the global population. It's part of a process that could lead to a new international treaty to protect the rights of older persons. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
This is the fifth session of the open-ended working group on aging. Its focus is on human rights, the care of older persons, violence, abuse, and legal and financial issues. Its work could lead to a UN Convention on the Rights of Older People. One of the groups driving the process is HelpAge International, which began its Age Demands Action campaign in 2007. HelpAge Chief Executive Toby Porter explains why he believes a convention is needed for those 60 years of age and older.
Older people around the world still suffer a lot of discrimination, a lot of abuse. There really is a sort of feeling that there have been decades of various commitments, plan of actions on aging, international agreements that more needed to be done for the world's older people, but it hasn't really delivered enough change.
He says when such a UN convention was approved for the disabled, it brought dramatic changes for the better. HelpAge has collected nearly 300,000 petition signatures from 112 countries in support of a convention for older people. The movement has gained the support of Nobel laureate Desmond Tutu of South Africa. In a statement, Tutu says this is not a minority issue. We are all growing older. Porter says it's important that people's rights are protected as they age.
By protecting people's rights and ensuring they're not discriminated against in health services, in the workplace, holding property, etc., by law, it's going to benefit society as a whole because it's going to make sure that the contribution of older people can be maximized and to make sure that older people aren't ignored.
Porter calls the campaign a real grassroots movement that includes many people who've suffered a lifetime of poverty, exclusion, and discrimination.
The world is rapidly aging. It's a triumph. It's an unconditional triumph of international and national development that people are living longer lives. The average age of the population is rising significantly, and this is a trend that will increase. It won't decrease. Older age is hopefully everybody's future.
The HelpAge chief executive says society faces the challenge of moving beyond negative stereotypes of aging.
Older people are actually massive contributors to society, massively contributing to their families. And so I really do feel that population aging is going to become one of the most important themes in the world.
The UN Open-Ended Working Group on Aging meets in New York from July 30th through August 1st. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
26 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Hundreds of Africa's emerging leaders are gathered in Washington for a three-day summit that includes a meeting with President Barack Obama. The summit is a highlight of a six-week U.S. fellowship that has given about 500 young Africans a chance to sharpen their skills through coursework and professional development. VOA's Pam Dawkins spoke to some participants who plan to remain in the United States to learn more about how they can help their home countries.
After 6 weeks spent sharpening their business skills, most of the participants will head back to Africa following the summit this week. But not all of them. Some have chosen to stay in the U.S. even longer and take part in internships with organizations across the country. Zimbabwe's Rumbidzai Dube, a lawyer and human rights defender, is among those staying. She wants to learn more about how to help victims of human trafficking.
I have been wanting to work in the field of human trafficking for a very long time. But because in Zimbabwe, a lot of people do not see this as an issue, there's very little buy-in, even from international NGOs.
Dube will have that opportunity through an internship with the State Government Criminal Services Division in Columbus, Ohio. She explains her goal.
To lobby my government to put together social protection measures that allow the victims to be reintegrated into society.
Takunda Chingonzo has a passion for startup companies. He is co-founder of two in his native Zimbabwe, including one that offers free public Wi-Fi services. He says African startups in general have a problem with sustainability.
I've come to realize that startups in Africa have this one fear of giving equity. We want to own our companies wholly, and yet when it comes to business viability, that doesn't make sense.
Chingonzo hopes that through his work with a California-based investment and strategic management firm, he will be able to find solutions to help African businesses. Gerald Afadani of Cameroon also has an interest in technology.
We are looking at the time when the world is evolving and moving to the digital level, and Cameroon cannot stay behind.
He plans to put his talents to use at the United Nations Foundation in New York. Afadani also has a vision that includes all of the participants in the Young African Leaders Initiative. He hopes all of the fellows will be better equipped and better skilled so that they can bring positive change to Africa and the world at large. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Millions of Muslims across the world are celebrating Eid al-Fitr holiday, marking the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. Hundreds of Africa's emerging leaders are gathered here in Washington for a three-day summit. Coming up, we'll have music from Uganda, and in our feature segment, we focus on the Young African Leadership Summit going on here in Washington, D.C. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And welcome back, Sunny.
Thank you, Kim. Good to be back.
Yes, and I understand you have some kudos for an Italian cyclist.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Vincenzo Nibali, the first Italian cyclist to win the Tour de France in 16 years. Nibali dominated cycling's greatest race nearly from the start 3 weeks ago in Britain. Reporter Lisa Bryant tells us more from Paris.
Eh bien, il égale sur ce Tour de France. Vincenzo Nibali, vainqueur.
29-year-old Sicilian Vincenzo Nibali cruised to victory on a summer's evening in Paris, winning by a total of 7.37 minutes over Frenchman Jean-Christophe Perrault. Another Frenchman, rising 24-year-old star Thibaut Pinot, was third overall. German Marcel Kittel won Sunday's final stage in a sprint finish. Nibali is the first Italian to win the Tour de France since 1998. He's also only one of six cyclists to win all three Grand Tours, France, Italy, and Spain. His victory came after pre-race favorites, defending champion Chris Froome of Britain and two-time winner Alberto Contador of Spain, bowed out earlier with injuries. Speaking from the victory podium at the Champs-Élysées, Nibali said it was one of the most beautiful moments in his life. He thanked his team and his family. Thousands of people watched the riders make their final loops in the French capital, ending a race that began in the British city of Leeds on July 5th. Matthew Antony had cycled here from London with a medical group.
We finished yesterday a four-day ride covering over 330 miles, and we're celebrating today by seeing a bit of professional cycling, seeing how fast the real people do it.
14-year-old Natalia Mestering is from Toronto.
Amazing. This is honestly an experience of a lifetime. I'm so excited to be here.
Pierre Gonard from the French city of Rouen was here with his father. The Gonard said they were happy to be on the Champs-Élysées to watch the riders finish. They've seen the Tour before in the mountains when the teams flash by in seconds. The riders lucked out on this last 137.5 kilometer leg of the Tour. After enduring stretches of rain and cold during the 3 weeks, they ended with sunshine for their last stage of the 101st Tour de France. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
I'm VOA's Sunny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Now let's go to Gao, Mali. That's where for 1 year, Gao's female basketball team was not able to dribble the ball or get on the court. That's because Islamist extremists who ruled northern Mali for most of 2012 imposed strict Sharia law, forcing women to cover their bodies in public. About 18 months later, French forces have pushed out the occupiers, and the team, like the rest of Mali's north, is slowly getting back on its feet. Katerina Heya met these women athletes in Gao and brings us their story.
As night falls over Gao in northern Mali, young women are practicing on a basketball court. Now that armed extremists have left, several girls in shiny tracksuit bottoms and low neck tops have joined the boys. Rama Tuture moves quickly across the basketball court's cracked surface. After 10 months of Islamist occupation and 1 year with no practice, the 19-year-old high school student is back in training.
Je vais à l'école en descend à 17h, 17h30. Je vais courir pour venir ici.
She says, as soon as classes are over for the day, she runs to practice or goes running with a friend. Toure says she does not get tired because she loves the game. Gao is known for its strong female basketball players, but Toure and many of her teammates had to sit on the sidelines due to the conflict that erupted in Mali in 2012.
Parce que les islamistes ne veulent pas que les filles portent.
18-year-old Maria Maiga says they could not wear shorts and tank tops normally worn on the basketball court, and only boys were allowed to play. While Gao was under the occupation of Al-Qaeda-linked Islamists, women were forced to cover their bodies in public, and men and women were banned from mixing socially. Violators faced public lashing or could have their hands chopped off. Women who refused to follow the dress code were arrested. Many also say they were raped. When the Islamists first arrived, Toure says she thought that she might just cover herself up and continue playing basketball. Instead, she boarded a bus heading south to the capital Bamako, together with tens of thousands of fleeing northerners.
Dans la crise que je quittais ici pour aller à Bamako, quand je partais là-bas, je n'ai pas entraîné.
She says it was a tough year, as she not only didn't get to play, she couldn't go to school. Toure says she really missed the game. Now, with the situation calmer, most of the girls are back home and have a lot of catching up to do. Making sure they do so is Omar Tonku Sisse, a retired coach in his 60s. He's also the founder of the Center for Training and Promoting Sports in Gao. He welcomes his kids with a smile and a cigarette in hand next to the central pitch. But he recalls the occupation with bitterness. The armed groups, they were fools, he says, and he doesn't want to be reminded of those times. As soon as Gao was liberated by French troops in January 2013, Sisse's sports center resumed its activities, but unfortunately, he says, his girls' team lost many of its best players, as many families remain displaced in the south for fear of continuing insecurity in the north.
C'est des jeunes, donc il faudrait du temps pour pouvoir les initier.
It's a young team, as you can see, he says. Many of the players have a lot to learn. Some have more potential than the others, but Sisse says they are rebuilding step by step. Meanwhile, living conditions in Gao remain difficult. Jobs are scarce. Certain food items are hard to find. Some government services are still lacking. The whole city is still recovering, along with much of Mali's north. But the team is fortunate to find friendly competitions with squads from neighboring towns. Just as fortunate, says Toure, is the fact that they can play at all with sporadic fighting persisting.
Maintenant ça va mais pas comme avant parce que avant on va jouer jusqu'à.
Toure says while she's happy to be back, Gao is not the same city. She notes that they used to play until 9, sometimes 10 in the evening, but now must finish much earlier because of insecurity. She says even when there's fighting in Kidal or Menaka, it affects them in Gao, and on those days they must be home by 6 p.m. As a reminder of the Islamists' continued presence, a French army vehicle passes by on the road opposite the Sandy Court. There are rumors of the Tuareg rebels recruiting. For these basketball players in Gao, the coach says they can play an important role in restoring the city to the way it used to be by helping to keep young people focused on positive contributions they can make rather than being lured by armed groups.
Bon, c'est ce que j'ai dit aux enfants de mettre du sérieux, hein? De se mettre dans
Sisse says, All he and many Gao residents want is the best from the girls and to help them reach out to young people to rebuild a future. Katharina Høie for VOA News in Gao.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Basketball superstar LeBron James has turned to Twitter to help him choose which number he'll wear next season with the Cleveland Cavaliers. About 10 days ago, LeBron tweeted 6 or 23, and he let his fans on social media decide. LeBron wore number 6 during 4 seasons with the Miami Heat and with the U.S. Olympic basketball team. He used number 23 in high school and during 7 previous seasons with Cleveland. When the tweets were counted, LeBron tweeted again, 23 it is. The tweet included a photo of James holding his number 23 Cavaliers jersey on draft night when he first entered the NBA, as well as ones in a new version of the Cleveland jersey, as well as one of him in his high school jersey. Turning to athletics, the IAAF World Junior Championships officially ended Sunday in the northwestern U.S. state of Eugene, Oregon. And Kenyan runners won medals on the final day of competition, as we hear now from our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Alfred Keter clocked 1 minute and 43.95 seconds to lead Joshua Masikonde in a 1-2 Kenyan win in 800 meters on Sunday. Bernard Kipyego and Titus Kipruto also clinched a 1-2 Kenyan triumph in 3,000 meter steeplechase. Ethiopians Dawit Seyaum and Gudei Tsegei won gold and silver in women's 1,500 meters, with Kenyan Sheila Keter a bronze medalist. Earlier on, Yomif Kelechi and Yasim Haji claimed a 1-2 Ethiopian triumph in men's 5,000 meters, with Kenyan Moses Letoyi placed third. Kenya's Roslyn Jepngetich and Daisy Jepkemei were second and third in girls' 3,000-meter steeplechase, while Nigerian Divine Oduduru claimed a silver medal in men's 200 meters. Staying in Eugene, Kenya placed second behind the United States of America in the final medal standings with 4 gold, 5 silver, and 7 bronze medals. Ethiopia is third, Uganda 15th, while Djibouti and Nigeria share 29th spot out of 40 nations on the medal table.
Thanks, Mark. That's our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma. In another highlight on the last day of competition at the IAAF World Junior Championships in Eugene, American Kendall Williams set a championship record in the women's 100-meter hurdles, clocking 12.89 seconds. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahyeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
In our feature segment, we focus on the Young African Leadership Summit going on here right in Washington, D.C. And next, possible discovery for a treatment of type 2 diabetes. But first, some music. Here is Hitaji from Uganda with Blue 3.
Machozi na yetu, What about the dreams? What about the fairy tales? Is there anything left to say now? Everybody's got a different picture now, but I won't let them get me down. Leaving around the lies and the things they do, it's not about to make me change my mind again. We've come from so far, and I ain't about to give it all away. Yeah, yeah.
time I talk to you, it seems a crime. Another's gonna find another tale to tell. Living on the brink is not an easy thing, but I hold on, cause you're with me. Standing on the ground, taking up a brow, singing it, living on the edge, baby, I'm about to pop, pop, pop. We stand a bigger chance, and I believe we'll make it through the rain. I'm in. What we got is something we should live to tell. Baby, take my hand, let me throw the trench. Meant for us to trip.
So let me make a sweet, let me make a turn strike. When the sun's coming up and I'ma pull the shots. What? I'ma pull the shots. Sun's coming up and I'ma pull the shots. Give me night jazz, one night saji.
My heart beat.
Niko bali, niko weke, moyoni.
Uganda's Blue 3 with Hitaji.
Well, this week, 500 young African leaders will hold a three-day summit in the American capital and meet the President, Barack Obama. They are Washington Fellows, part of the administration's effort to empower young talent called the President's Young African Leaders Initiative. For the past few weeks, they have been studying business and entrepreneurship, civic leadership, or public management at several U.S.-based universities. One fellow is James Alban Greaves of Liberia. He's originally from No. 3 District, Grand Bassa County, and working on juvenile issues with the Ministry of Justice in Monrovia. He's had over 4 years of experience in youth development and child justice advocacy. James is currently the chair on the Independent Accreditation Committee of Orphanages in Liberia. He helps with the design of programs for juveniles who come into conflict with the law.
I see myself as a potential leader in the first place, and I'm grateful for this recognition. I believe I have been selected for the YALI program because of my background, which is juvenile justice. And the selection was done by the U.S. government. And I'm a member of a team that implements a juvenile diversion program, which channels juveniles in conflict with the law from formal judicial proceedings to some specially designed programs. So I think it's a great recognition, and I appreciate that. I hope to help develop my country by planning to working on with stakeholders, as I'm currently doing, to improve Liberia's juvenile justice system, and by helping to introduce and implement programs that are specifically designed specifically to serve as alternatives to incarceration, and looking at juvenile delinquency program as well, and having myself involved in other programs like community service, employing volunteerism amongst juveniles to foster restorative justice rather than impunity. So I have been in the U.S. for the past several weeks, studying at the Howard University, and the selection of Howard University is no mistake. I've had an integrative learning experience in public management, so I have been able to learn on information, technology, entrepreneurship, and competitiveness for economic growth. I've been able to discuss higher education issues. I've been able to look at the impact of information technology on decision-making. And interestingly, we have not only focused on the academic side, but with issues alone, but we've been able to do site visits, visit governmental and non-governmental areas. We've been able to volunteer our services at some institutions, and we've been able to network among ourselves and other Americans as well, and including institutions. And we've been able to do cultural and civic activities, visiting museums and historic places.
So these experiences have indeed further improved and strengthened my understanding of public management, and this will help me to be more effective upon my return to Liberia. And I'm grateful for this opportunity. And important that we have also been able to share our experiences from the continent, best practices. So these are great things. We not just only learning, but sharing our experiences as well. Liberia is indeed in the midst of many challenges, like any other country. And importantly, we have a youthful population. Politically, we are a democratic nation, and we go to the polls to elect our leaders. So I cannot be very definite on where I think the next leadership will come from. But the core principles, priorities for all of us are the promotion of youth education, workforce development that has to do with job creation, job training, and job placement. And the people will certainly elect whoever promotes these priorities. So every citizen has the potential to lead and to contribute to the reconstruction of Liberia. As a country, this is what we should be striving for, to harness the creativity and the contribution of all Liberians in rebuilding our country economically, politically, and socially. And I'm thankful to my parents, my mentors, my friends, and all the peace-loving people of Liberia for the uninterrupted peace. My future to lead depends on this peace. If I have the chance to meet President Obama, and I will ask him what would be his plans or his engagement be like beyond the presidency, knowing that the U.S. Constitution does not allow two terms. So he will be a relatively young president. What would be his plans for the continent?
That was James Alban Greaves of Liberia, a fellow in President Obama's Young African Leaders Initiative. The 500 fellows participating in the initiative are meeting here in Washington this week.
A single injection of a protein that keeps a diabetic person's blood sugar under control for several days could become available in the next few years. Researchers believe the discovery could signal a new generation of treatment for type 2 diabetes, a disease that is skyrocketing around the world. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Scientists have known about the protein called FGF1 for several decades, but researchers discovered the potential of the molecule, which is part of a family of so-called growth factors, when they injected it into mice that were engineered to have type 2 or adult onset diabetes. The blood sugar levels of the experimental animals were restored to a healthy range for more than 2 days after a single injection. In the adult onset form of the disease, the body's cells do not absorb sugar or glucose derived from food. FGF1 appears to resensitize the body to insulin, which transports glucose into cells, normalizing blood sugar levels.
So as a result, the combination of FGF1 plus the body's insulin rebalances the equation and allows the glucose to be controlled as if it was normal.
But Ron Evans, an expert on endocrine-related diseases, stresses that FGF1 is not a cure for diabetes. Current treatments for type 2 diabetes are aimed at boosting the body's production of insulin in order to lower glucose levels in the blood, but they can have serious side effects. If and when regulators approve FGF1 for the treatment of diabetes, it would have to be injected like insulin every other day. Evans and his colleagues at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies are looking into formulating a longer-acting form of the protein. Worldwide, adult-onset diabetes has reached epidemic proportions as carbohydrate-rich foods, particularly fast foods, have become readily available. Excess weight and inactivity usually trigger the disease. Evans is excited about the prospect of a new treatment for diabetes.
It's exciting because it's a new role for an old molecule. And it just shows you that there's a lot to be learned. And it's a lesson because after 30 years to find what may be the true function of this molecule came as a surprise. No one was looking for this.
Salk researchers report their findings in the journal Nature. Evans thinks clinical trials of FGF1, which he says is safe, will likely begin in 12 to 18 months. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In one of the most blatant violations to date of their June 10th pledge to end the fighting and enter talks to establish a transitional government, South Sudanese rebels attacked and are seeking control of Nasser, a strategic town in Upper Nile State. Opposition forces loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar launched a ground attack against the South Sudanese army early July 20th, capturing some government positions. Army spokesmen claim that the rebels were eventually driven away with heavy losses. Sporadic fighting is said to continue around the area. The parties have repeatedly agreed to negotiate to end the fighting, only to see it continue. Prodded by the regional bloc, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, as well as by the threat of sanctions by the African Union, United States, and others in the international community, both sides agreed to an August 10th deadline for formation of a transition government. And progress on this front is urgently needed. Meanwhile, the conflict is in its seventh month. Thousands are dead, and more than 1.5 million people have been driven from their homes. Food stocks are running low in northern regions of the country, where the fighting has been fiercest, and aid agencies fear South Sudan could tip into famine. The United States strongly condemns the attack on Nasser and calls on both parties to immediately end all such actions and fully adhere to their previous truce agreements. With the destruction inflicted on Nasser, the repeated suffering of South Sudan's people, and the worsening humanitarian crisis, it is increasingly urgent that both parties immediately recommit themselves to inclusive political negotiations. The cycle of violence that has plagued South Sudan for too long must come to an end.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000, and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.